Hi, I want to thank you for having me. I just came back from the Elevare 2010, the Elevare Games, also here in San Francisco this last weekend. Did any of you hear about how that went, or was anybody paying attention to that? Okay, great. We're going to start with an overview of what this concept is. It's not that pretty picture, but I just happen to like that. The old science fiction of this concept had this huge mammoth cable, 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 feet across, stretched from the Earth, probably in Sri Lanka, up to an asteroid or an artificial moon out in space. It's the basic idea of you have a ball and a string, you're spinning that over your head, the string in the middle stays straight, the rotation provides centripetal acceleration, gravity holds it down, centripetal acceleration pulls it out, and once you have that string, you could essentially climb back and forth. And that's been the science, that's basically where science fiction left it for a really long time. They kept coming up with this phrase, unobtainium, some magic, mythical material that was never going to happen. Well, I'm here to tell you that people in this room are probably creating unobtainium every day. There have been and there continue to be advances in this area that are happening so quickly, so expansively, that about three years ago, after at the result of a NASA's Institute for Advanced Concepts study, I decided that it was time to start working on this thing for real. So, as you probably all know, there's nothing out there now that's strong enough to make this. The carbon nanotubes are coming along. There's been some pretty interesting theory about how we can make this stuff. But at the end of the day, there is no nanotube out there yet that will get this job done yet. Los Alamos National Labs came up with a 4-centimeter long nanotube early this year. There's been rumor of a 10-centimeter long single-walled nanotube out there floating around that hasn't been confirmed yet. Regardless of whether those happen, we think that there's probably a material out there that's strong enough to start making this. So let's talk about what this is a little bit. And then we'll talk about my company's role in this. So the idea as baseline from the, from the NASA study was that you would have four rockets that sent up standard payloads, standard Atlas or Delta rockets, would go to low Earth orbit, bringing four packages, basically two large spools of thread, those are the gray things. The great big disc is a solar panel and then a rocket motor. Now what you're doing here is you have to fire this rocket for about 3 months and slowly drop the ribbon back down to Earth. So there aren't very many rockets that can do that. So it's an ion rocket. So you're beaming power to it. Instead of having your solar panels pointing up towards the sun, you point them down and then using a free electron laser, beam power to yourself, and at the same time, slowly, gently push away from the Earth, extending that ribbon all the way its full distance. And its full distance is about 62,000 miles. So this ribbon, as it's deployed, is about 8 inches wide. That's pretty fragile. It's virtually paper thin, and thousands of miles long. You drop that back down to the Earth. In this case, we're aiming for a location on the equator, directly south of San Diego, directly west of Quito, Ecuador. There's a great big dull spot in the middle of the ocean. We'd land on a ship. We'd land in the ocean, recover it, and cut off the bottom part and put the rest on the ship. In this vision, it looks somewhat like a oil tanker. In the original concepts, it was going to be an oil tanker. As we learn more about this program, that's no longer a good solution. Once the initial ribbon is in place, we then start quickly working on the construction. So this is the same concept that the Romans used when they would build a bridge. They take a bow and arrow with a string, shoot it across a canyon, and pull another string and another string and another string until you built it up. And in this case, the yellow is being added to the gray, and it's becoming wider and wider, and as a result, becoming stronger and stronger. And in the original NASA baseline, which is probably going to change sometime early next year, the ultimate ribbon is about 3 feet wide and can carry 5 tons of cargo every day, 200 trips a year, or 13 tons of cargo every 3 days. And what that ultimately is an infrastructure system to climb back and forth inexpensively, reliably, and safely back and forth into space. There's some cost estimates out there now that say that we can be either 1 or 5% of current costs to get back and forth. So instead of $20,000 to $40,000 per pound to get to GEO, the guess is we can get there for $400 per pound. So that's where we're going. We've got a very long, long ways to go. It's a 15-year project. We're in our second year, so we've got a ways to go. But we're making progress. And a couple of things that have been happening recently. Just this weekend was part of a competition. NASA sponsored the Centennial Challenge, and what that was the competition for ultimately $200,000 for a really strong string that would lead towards this, and another $200,000 for a power beaming system of a robot that can climb up and down a string. Now, both of those happened this weekend, neither of which were won, but there were some pretty interesting designs and there were some pretty interesting developments. They had something like 7 or 8 teams competing. I think it was 11 total. And some of the ideas were really clever. There was this competition spurring some out-of-the-box thinking, stuff that hadn't been considered before. My company is working on 2 parts of this problem. One is a robot that can climb into space, but a long ways from now. And the other part is, and the reason I'm here, is we're developing our carbon nanotube factory out in Millville, New Jersey. So we're pretty excited about that. I'm going to show you a brief video, and I apologize for the choppiness of it. I'm the cameraman, so I'm not a professional cameraman, and there's a lot of sagebrush out there. I was stumbling around in the desert. What you see up there at the top is a big balloon. It's about 12 feet across or so, helium balloon. And then that first yellow part was a ribbon. Nothing special about the ribbon. It's a standard fiberglass composite. And then that's our little robot. It's about 5.5 feet tall, about six inches wide. And what it's doing is it's climbing up a string. Now, it looks a little peculiar because what actually happened here, we started out and it was looking like it was going straight up, you know, at a slight angle because of the wind. What in fact happened was as the bot is climbing up, it's adjusting the center of mass and the equilibrium of the system, and so it went horizontal about 150 feet before the drift and the lift of the system compensated, and suddenly it goes vertical. So I'm underneath this thing looking like this as it's making that transition. So it's pretty unexpected, but a pretty good day. We climbed about 1,000 feet off of this test. We've got FAA clearances to climb up to 1 mile. We think we're pretty close to that. Had we had slightly better luck, we think we could have made it a couple weeks ago. And that's where we're at on the hardware side. On the theory side, we've gotten a lot of universities involved with this project. Harvard, Stanford, MIT, Air Force Academy, Georgia Tech. There's about 15 major schools involved with this thing at some level or another. Uncle Sam put in the first about $600,000, and then they've just recommitted another $400,000. But in the scope of a project like this, it's a long ways from what we need. So we turn to the angel community. We have one angel, and we have a few smaller investors. And this project is in the transition stage from being a science fiction gee whiz concept to real world engineering. And that's how I want to approach the problem. I'm a finance guy. I'm not an engineer. I'm not a scientist. I need to figure out how to make money out of this thing so we can pay the bills, keep the lights on, and pay the internet connections. And so we're making this an application that'll generate revenues as a high-altitude sensing platform. So you could provide wireless communications over a community. You could provide traffic data at higher altitudes. It makes sense for a radio system or a cell system. And at higher than that, you're looking at a Earth sensing environment, maybe a military application. So that's the hardware side of the robotics. The hardware side of the nanotubes is a little harder to describe. I'm presuming everybody here knows more about nanotubes than I do. But ultimately, we're talking about a substance that, whether this is built or not, is going to change the world. Long before you see an elevator climbing into the sky, you're going to see bridges constructed in a brand new way. You're going to see buildings constructed in a new way. I'm not going to get into any of the hype. I think you guys have heard that and are sick to death of it like I am. But there are going to be some pretty interesting concepts that come out of this thing. And the way that we're approaching this project is, whether the elevator is built or not, this project should still spin off an awful lot of interesting, innovative technologies that will revolutionize how we live our lives. Look back at the Panama Canal. There was no way of knowing before you started digging the ditch in the swamp that we were going to revolutionize our medical industry as a result of digging a ditch in the swamp. But people got sick and people were dying, and they recruited an awful lot of doctors to solve an awful lot of problems. That was a spinoff that nobody could have predicted. When you're talking about a mammoth infrastructure development, one that's going to radically change society, there is no way to predict where those ideas, those clever inventions are going to come from and what impacts they are going to have on the society and the culture that you live in. That's where we're approaching this, how we're approaching this problem. We know there's going to be long, strong string. We think it's inevitable. Whether our project is a catalyst for it or not, there's too many people that can make a lot of money making long, strong string to assume that it's not going to happen. There's other things, though, that we're working on. We're just in the process of, that's our nanotube. Well, that's the beginnings of our nanotube environment. Let me shut that off here. The furnaces that we're starting to make out in Millville, New Jersey are on order right now. We're going to be making multi-walled carbon nanotubes. There's nothing particularly special about them. Those nanotubes are not going to be the kind that we ultimately need to build an elevator to space. Our goal there is pretty straightforward. Know how to make a lot of nanotubes. You know, part of the promise of this idea is that this work is being done in a laboratory, but at some point you have to take it out of the lab and start mass producing and start making a lot of this stuff. And right now there's not a really good way of doing that. So that's one of the problems that we're tackling. I'm curious what your reactions to this is. You know, when I go out and speak, normally it's to space advocacy communities. It's to people that are already involved with the concept and think it's pretty interesting. This is my first presentation in front of a community that's really interested in a completely different technology. So I'm curious, I can't possibly make a PowerPoint that could answer your questions, because it's a very large project and there's a lot of complicated details in it. So I'd rather turn it, make this a little bit more interactive and get your reactions, because that's pretty helpful to me. Any comments, questions, how we're going to make this thing, what we're going to do with it? Yeah.
I'm curious about the material side of this. Sure. Have you done calculations in terms of tensile loading forces to hold such a strand in place? And if you could make a carbon nanotube, a single wall carbon nanotube that long, would it be strong enough to support its own weight? Have you done that kind of calculation?
There's some work being done at Rutgers right now about on that topic. The answer is probably it will work. Right now, the NASA baseline says you need a 65 GPA material as a minimum, and for a factor of two safety, you're going to need 130 GPA material. To put that in perspective, we've got a long ways to go on that. Industrial steel is typically rated around 3 GPA, so you're talking a long, long ways to go. But yeah, it does look like it'll handle the forces and the stresses. There's some questions about the ribbon moving, because it's going to be under oscillating all the time.
And the atmosphere, too. 1,000-mile-an-hour atmosphere force on it?
The atmosphere is less of a factor than you might think. You're under a fair amount of tension. You're under about 20 tons worth of tension. So it should be able to handle the wind forces pretty well. What's actually a more interesting curiosity is solar winds and radiation and atomic oxygen and orbital debris, the stuff that's further out that we have. Because this ribbon is so long, solar winds are actually going to push on this thing. It's got a huge sail area, and that has not been calculated very well.
What about thermal effects from heating and need to cool it or to transfer heat, right, and that kind of stuff?
The thermal flux was, we think, one of the biggest technical problems. It's going to heat up very, very quickly and cool down very, very quickly, and every time it goes in and out of a shadow. So,
I'll ask you about your tech guy afterwards.
Yeah, sure. just to be fair here, this has gone in front of an awful lot of guys a lot smarter than me. So if I may not be able to answer your specific question, but I'll do the best I can. Yeah.
What are the types of suspension bridges you could build with these materials? How quick and easy would it be? Could you replace roads, railroads, and so on with that technology because you have such a vastly stronger capability?
Sure, and that's really that really is going to be a gauge of whether or not this thing is possible, is when you start seeing large structures like that developed. There's already been talk about a Gibraltar Bridge, a Bering Strait Bridge, things that are, you know, fairly major engineering efforts. If you can presume a material 30 times stronger than steel, that opens up a pretty wide range of a lot of interesting concepts. The span of a bridge, I don't think, is going to ever be an issue again. It's just the question of, I think it's going to come down to engineering and economics rather than material strengths. Does that kind of answer the question? No, but there's a bridge company here in San Francisco. They're working on the Oakland Bridge. Can't think of their name off the top of my head. I can't think of the name of it. Anyway, they're looking into some of these applications. So we've had some chats with them. This thing is a lot closer to a bridge-like project than it ever is going to be a aerospace-type project. Basically, you're a bridge anchored on one end and going up infinitely to the top to the other end.
Yeah.
Hi, yeah, it sounds like a very interesting project. I was wondering along the lines of material questions, you're using nanotubes to produce something, if I plug the numbers right into my calculator, that would be 114 cubic feet of material. I was just wondering about the implications of the scale of the project in using nanotechnology.
Think about the company that made your shirt. They make cloth in million-mile bolts all the time. When you cross bridges, they've got a million miles worth of cable in those bolts. The scale isn't that big. I mean, we're talking about something that's 800 tons. 800 tons is, it's a large ship. It's like a cruise ship size or a railroad car. I mean, there's a lot of it. But like I say, you know, if we're able to complete this project, nanotubes are going to be ubiquitous. They're going to be everywhere in everything. And it's going to take a while to shift. It took something like 40 to, depending on where you to you know, set your timelines, 40 to 50 years for plastics to be, or rubber to be significant. Rubber was a classified topic in World War II. And can you imagine your life without it now? So it may take a while for the nanotubes to be dispersed everywhere, but I think it's going to happen long before you see this, that our number is going to be trivial compared to the other things it's going into.
Hi. How are you dealing with the export control and geopolitical problems? You don't want to get the same result as the X Prize, where right. you solve the problem and then the government tells you you're not allowed to deploy it.
Right. That's, I think, believe it or not, a trickier problem than the thermal flux or the technology. The technology is valuable enough that whether we do it or somebody else, there's a lot of people that can make a lot of money off of the details of working on this project. So, and they, I think that they will. Those engineering problems are really a factor of time, brain power, and capital. However, social and political problems, legal problems, international law issues, that's a whole nother game. And we actually, I was just saying to Jillian from Foresight just an hour ago, that we think that this is every bit as much a political campaign as it is an engineering process. Look back at our space program. We've had three presidential declarations that say we're going to go to the moon. Only one mattered. Only one was significant. Only one fired the imagination enough to get people involved. If the leaders lead, that's great, but then you have to have the followers follow. And so these social political problems are really tricky, and I don't have a good answer for it. Nanotubes are currently, I believe, restricted through ITAR. It's funny, I think you can import them, but you can't export them, which is an interesting curiosity.
Yeah. So why would you do the work in a country like this that won't let it out?
Because I don't believe that the whole project can be completed without the direct support of the United States Air Force. We really promote an international program. On our website, we talk about the International Public Inclusion Policy. But at the end of the day, if the United States is not intimately involved with this thing, I think it's going to be in big trouble. We're talking about balance of power shifting technology.
Well, exactly. So it seems like it might be good to build several of them at the same time.
I personally think that's not a bad idea. But I don't think you're going to get a space race building another elevator. Like, China's not going to build an elevator, or Russia's probably not going to build an elevator. I don't think. You know, if they do, great. Maybe we'll get a little bit more funding from Uncle Sam. Right now, we're privately funded. Yeah.
I had a question technically. How do you deal with wind drag during the descent? And two, you're going to have a window of opportunity from the time it starts out as a tiny thread to the actual final lifting system of lightning strikes.
Right. We have two different, the lightning is still an open question. One thing I want to stress is that we don't even have all the questions yet, let alone all the answers. Okay, we've only been at this for about 2 years, so give us a little bit of time. But we've got two different lightning guys, equally credentialed, completely disagree on that answer. So one says that it'll never be built because as it's dropping through the atmosphere, it'll be subject to so many lightning strikes, it'll just, you know, explode. The other guy says, not an issue, it'll dissipate all the charge around it, don't worry about it. Well, you know, you're not going to spend $10 billion and invest 15 years of your life on something that, right? So those would be answers that I would really like to have sooner rather than later. But again, you know, right now we don't see anything that is a showstopper. We don't see any problem that is fundamentally, you know, that we cannot overcome. And I'm sorry, what was the first part of the question? Just shout it.
Wind drag.
As it's dropping. Right. It's going to be dropping really slow. This is not like an Apollo reentry where it's, you know, thousands of miles an hour. We're dropping it down. So you launch it up. You're about 300 miles up. You fire off your rockets, and this is slowly unreeling from this point all the way out. But you're calculating carefully so that the bottom drops back into the atmosphere very gently, only about 25 miles an hour. The rocket has a couple purposes. It's to push the string all the way out, but at the same time to mimic, not actually, but to mimic a geosynchronous orbit. So as this is dropping down, it's going to drop roughly in the area that we want it to. And we've got advantages that the Apollo guys never had. We've got GPS, we've got better active and passive radar and sonar. So we're going to know, we're going to be able to figure out roughly where it's going to land. It'll, of course, get pushed away. As my balloon test that we just showed a little while ago shows that, you know, drift is a factor. But we're going to know roughly where it's going to be, within 1,500 miles-ish. And you'll have catcher boats down there. I want to let somebody else. I'm happy to talk about this afterwards. I also, somebody check me on time, by the way. Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I hate to ask this because it seems so obvious, but when I used to fly kites, you know, I would actually, the string would break and the kite would fly away. Now, if something hits this thing and it just breaks completely, let's say a meteorite or something like that, is that a stupid question?
No. In fact, I have to compliment you on the way that you asked that question, because the number one question is, what if a plane flies into it? And you at least, you know, got around that one. By saying meteor. So thank you for at least, you know, acknowledging that we have, you know, a few extra brain cells. The plane question, just to answer it, is we're hundreds of miles away from plane, and we're 400 miles from planes and 600 miles away from shipping routes. But no, you absolutely do have to be concerned. There's orbital debris up there. There's pieces the size of your fingernail, and there's big rocks, and there's dead satellites the size of your chair. No, those are real issues, and the joke around the office is we're playing cosmic dodgeball. You do have to have a recovery scenario. I'll talk about that in a second, but you also need to be able to dodge these objects. Now, NORAD is already focusing on, they're watching objects that are 10 centimeters and larger. We want to bring it down to about 3 centimeters, which is a whole new technology development in radar. And then because I'm a commercial guy, I want to sell that back to NORAD. You've got all this debris. Like, we're in a particular line, and you've got especially low Earth orbit satellites, specifically observation satellites, are going to cross our path on a really frequent basis. There's about, there's depending on who you ask, there's about 4,000 notable objects that we have to worry about. So one of the reasons we're on the ship, by the way, one of the reasons we're on the ship is to avoid lightning, because this place doesn't get lightning. But by moving the ship, you create an oscillation. You can track where the debris is coming from, project its trajectory, and be where it's not. You know, have our ribbon where the debris is not going to be. Now, that's going to work on larger objects. That's not going to work for the really, really small stuff. So there's a danger zone that's between 200 and 800 miles up that is where we've got about 95% of our likely problems are going to occur in this area. So if you'll, you know, accept that we're probably masters of long, strung string because we've just gotten 62,000 miles of it, what we're going to do is we'll have 3 more thousand miles in a tripod with ships at the bottom. So if you snap in that area, you can reel it down and reconnect. That's one part of the answer. The other part of the answer is the whole thing is in equilibrium. There's tension, but it's basically a very, 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 very long satellite. If you adjust the center of mass by dropping some of the top down, the ribbon should gently float back into the Earth. Okay?
I think we might be... thank you so much, Michael. It's absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
Join me in thanking Michael.